I remember how being young and black and gay and lonely felt. A lot of it was fine, feeling I had the truth and the light and the key, but a lot of it was purely hell.
It was a process of not only coming out in the industry, but coming out to myself, to where I went, you know what, you have two roads you can choose here. You can choose to love yourself and choose to go with a God that loves you, or you can continue on this path of self-hate and self-destruction.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. International law honors an Aussie gay war veteran's legacy, profiling pen mightier-than-sword warrior poet Audre Lorde, and animatedly out in Hollywood with an irreverently queer duck. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 6, 2003. In a decision with global implications, the United Nations Human Rights Committee has unanimously found that Australia's denial of pension benefits to a gay war veteran's surviving partner violates the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, it was announced this week. The quasi-judicial UN panel declared that Australia had illegally discriminated on the basis of sexual orientation and had failed to present any evidence that its differential treatment of heterosexual and same-gender unmarried partners is reasonable and objective. The international body ordered Australia to reconsider the plaintiff's case without discrimination and, if necessary, to amend its laws to achieve that. It further asserted that Australia is under an obligation to ensure that similar violations of the covenant do not occur in the future. That may extend the impact of the ruling beyond veterans' entitlements into many other areas of Australian federal law that use a similar exclusively heterosexual definition of couple, including taxation, social security, and old age benefits. Australia has 90 days to respond with an action plan for compliance. Australian Lawyers for Human Rights President Simon Rice told the Australian Associated Press the ruling is an authoritative decision in international law. Australia either acts with respect for international law, amends the law in order to give equality to same-sex couples, or Australia snubs international law.
The plaintiff in the current UN case is Edward Young of Sydney, whose partner of 38 years, World War II veteran Larry Keynes, died 5 years ago. Young took his case to the UN Human Rights Committee 4 years ago after Australia's Department of Veterans Affairs rejected his application for pension benefits because they were not a heterosexual couple. Young said, "I did not apply for the pension for the sake of the money. It was a matter of principle, justice, and equality before the law. The government was refusing to honor Larry's war service and was refusing to treat him the same as heterosexual veterans. The government seems to think it is okay for gay men and lesbians to fight and die for their country, but still wants to treat us like second-class citizens when it comes to recognizing our relationships." Gays and lesbians have been free to serve openly in the Australian Defence Forces for a decade. In response to the UN ruling, openly gay Australian Senator from West Australia Brian Gregg announced that his Australian Democratic Party will reintroduce its equality legislation, called the Sexuality and Gender Status Discrimination Bill, which both the ruling coalition and the Australian Labour Party have failed to support since 1995.
The European Parliament this week called on its member nations to establish full equal marriage and adoption rights for gay and lesbian couples. Although the EP has previously taken stands in support of legal recognition of same-gender couples, this recommendation for marriage and adoption is a first, with a similar move having failed just last year. The action came in the form of approving the EP's annual human rights review, Fundamental Rights in the EU in 2002, which included a statement that member states should abolish all forms of discrimination, whether legislative or de facto, which are still suffered by homosexuals, in particular as regards the right to marry and adopt children. Only the Netherlands and Belgium have extended marriage to gay and lesbian couples, although seven other European Union countries offer substantive registered partnerships. Although the EP report does not carry legal weight with member nations, the marriage and adoption statement generated heated debate. The vote was 50% of delegates in support, 44% opposed, and 5% abstaining. Obviously, this action put the EP in direct opposition to a recent Vatican document, which harshly denounced legal recognition of same-gender couples and specifically called on politicians to block it. So it's not surprising that on the very same day, the EP adopted a resolution expressing disapproval of the Roman Catholic Church's attempt to interfere in politics.
But this week it was the Russian Orthodox Church that was in an uproar over a gay marriage. In what's believed to be a first for that thousand-year-old denomination, Father Vladimir performed a private marriage ceremony in a chapel in the Volga River city of Nizhny Novgorod for Denis Gogolev and Mikhail Borisov. After what the church called a thorough investigation, the local bishop defrocked Father Vladimir for sacrilege. The diocese declared in a press release that the Russian Orthodox Church is against single-sex marriages and condemns homosexual relations as a deadly sin. The church also called the wedding a provocation to call public attention to homosexual marriages, and that does seem to be the couple's intention. Gogolev was quoted by the BBC as saying, "Misha and I want to show that gays can and should live in Russia and quite openly." The BBC also identified both men as candidates in December's parliamentary elections. Other Russian religious leaders joined in condemning gay and lesbian marriage. Reports are inconsistent as to whether the priest simply accepted the couple or had actually been expecting Gogolev to bring a bride rather than a groom. But apparently the 15,000 rubles paid for his services was remarkably high.
The bishops of North America's nine major Orthodox Christian churches declared their opposition to same-gender marriages last week. The Standing Conference of the Canonical Orthodox Bishops in the Americas, led by Greek Orthodox Archbishop Demetrios, issued a statement expressing their deep concern at the prospect of legal gay and lesbian marriage and asserting that they cannot and will not bless same-sex unions. They said, "Marriage is necessarily monogamous and heterosexual. Today, however, this divine purpose is increasingly questioned, challenged, or even denied, even within some faith communities, as social and political pressures work to normalize, legalize, and even sanctify same-sex unions." They labeled that situation a moral crisis.
Egypt's Orthodox Coptic Church also took a formal stand this week against same-gender marriages and ordination of gay clergy. Responding in part to openly partner U.S. gay Gene Robinson becoming the Anglican Bishop of New Hampshire, a synod chaired by Pope Shenouda III issued a statement published by the National MENA News Service saying, "These moves run against the teachings of the Holy Book. They threaten the stability of marriage, the formation of the family, the morality of society, the sanctity of the church, and the future of ecumenical efforts. Therefore, we strongly condemn and oppose the marriage between homosexuals and their ordination in the clergy." Estimates of Egypt's Copts range from less than 6 to more than 10 million people.
In a call to return to what he called Islam's true teachings, Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad also reacted to Robinson's elevation in his last nationally televised Independence Day address. Mahathir is scheduled to step down in November after 22 years as PM. He became the subject of international criticism after the 1998 imprisonment of his protege and heir apparent Anwar Ibrahim on sodomy charges that were widely believed to be fabricated by a political conspiracy. Mahathir is still something of a hero in Malaysia, though, and a huge crowd turned out for a massive celebration that was largely devoted to honoring him. In his speech, Mahathir blamed Malaysia's rising crime rates and other problems on the influence of the morally declining West. He said, "Western films idolize sex, violence, murders, and wars. Now they permit homosexual practices and accept religious leaders with openly gay lifestyles. They are very angry, especially their reporters, many of whom are homosexuals, when we take legal action against such practices." Malaysia's sodomy law provides for up to 20 years imprisonment plus flogging, and Mahathir warned that if there are any homosexuals in Malaysia, they had better mend their ways. Mahathir said Western-style democracy and civil rights aren't suitable for Malaysia.
And finally, the highly politicized marriage debate in the U.S. this week centered on hearings by the Senate Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on the Constitution. Its chair, Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn, says he called them to determine if there is a need to buttress the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act. That law bars the federal government from recognizing same-gender couples, as well as allowing the states to ignore any gay or lesbian marriage another state may someday perform. Many viewed the hearings as a move to advance a one-man, one-woman marriage amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which has been introduced in the House but not yet in the Senate. The hearings were also widely viewed as a way for Republicans to force Democrats to publicly declare their positions on a potential wedge issue. Cornyn denied he was pressing for the amendment, but it seemed to be the main concern of those actually giving testimony at the hearing. The subcommittee's Democrats also had no trouble speaking out against the amendment, as opposed to speaking out for equal marriage rights.
One witness, selected by a Democratic committee member, was Keith Bradkowski, who lost his partner of 11 years, pilot Jeff Coleman, in one of the four planes hijacked by terrorists on September 11, 2001. Bradkowski detailed the difficulties he'd had proving his relationship after Coleman's death because marriage had not been available to them. Jeff died without a will, which meant that while I dealt with losing him, I also had huge anxiety about maintaining the home we shared together. Without a marriage license to prove I was Jeff's next of kin, even inheriting basic household possessions became a legal nightmare. The terrorists who attacked this country killed people not because they were gay or straight, but because they were Americans. He said, "Jeff and I only sought to love and take care of each other. I do not understand why that is a threat to some people. 2 years ago, we were all united against the common threat of terrorism. Now, less than 2 years later, I'm sitting here and being told my relationship was a threat to our country."
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 6th, 2003, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
In his most recent role, this actor is heard but not seen. Meet the live-action persona of a popular cartoon queer later in the program. She was the sister of Sister Outsider, the new spelling of Zami's name, the graceful and indelible black unicorn. Kathy Sanchez profiles one of the matriarchs of lesbian literature.
Warrior, teacher, gifted, generous, courageous, exuberant. These words and more have been used to describe Audre Lorde, poet, author, and activist. Born on February 18, 1934, to immigrant parents, Lorde was the youngest of three daughters. Her career as a poet and activist began in high school when her school's paper refused to publish a poem she wrote. She turned then to a national scene and had her poem published in 17 magazine. This was indicative of Lorde's life, breaking boundaries and moving beyond. She grew up in Harlem during the Depression and graduated from Columbia University and Hunter College. She held numerous teaching positions, toured the world as a lecturer, and collected a host of awards and honors for her works. Thanks to recordings from the Pacifica Radio Archives, we are able to savor some of Lorde's best works and thoughts. Here, Lorde recalls being young, black, and lesbian in New York City.
"I remember how being young and black and gay and lonely felt. A lot of it was fine, feeling I had the truth and the light and the key, but a lot of it was purely hell. There were no mothers, no sisters, no heroes. We had to do it alone, like our sister Amazons, the riders on the loneliest outposts of the kingdom of Dahomey. We, young and black and fine and gay, sweated out our first heartbreaks with no school nor office chums to share that confidence over lunch hour. Just as there were no rings to make tangible the reason for our happy secret smiles, there were no names nor reasons given or shared for the tears that messed up the lab reports or the library bills. We were good listeners and never asked for double dates, but didn't we know the rules? Why did we always seem to think that friendships between women were important enough to care about? Always, we moved in a necessary remoteness that made, 'What did you do this weekend?' seem like an impertinent question. We discovered and explored our attention to women alone, sometimes in secret, sometimes in defiance, sometimes in little pockets that almost touched. Why are those little black girls always either whispering together or fighting? But always alone, against a greater aloneness.
Much of Lord's work was rooted in anger and sexism that makes the history and treatment of African Americans and women. Lord carried themes of violence, hunger, struggle, pain, love, hope, and growth in her works. In her book, The Cancer Journals, Lord chronicled her battle with breast cancer. She challenged the traditional notions of illness and advocated women's ability and right to make decisions about their health.
Breast cancer and mastectomy are not unique experiences. They're ones that are shared by thousands of American women. Each of these women has a particular voice to be raised in what must become a female outcry against all preventable cancers, as well as against the secret fears that allow these cancers to flourish. May these words serve as encouragement for other women to speak and to act out of our experiences with cancer and other threats of death. For silence has never bought us anything of worth. Most of all, may these words underline the possibilities of self-healing and the richness of living for all women. There is a commonality, you know, of isolation and painful reassessment that is shared by all women with breast cancer, whether this commonality is recognized by us or not. Now, it is not my intention here to judge the woman who chooses the path of prosthesis, which I think is a path of silence and invisibility, the woman who wishes to be the same as before. She has survived on another kind of courage, and she is not alone. Each one of us struggles daily with the pressures of conformity, the loneliness of difference, from which these choices seem to offer escape. I only know that they do not work for me, nor for other women who, not without fear, have survived cancer by scrutinizing its meaning within our lives and by attempting to integrate this crisis into some useful strength for change.
The Cancer Journals won the American Library Association Gay Caucus Book of the Year Award in 1981. Lord wrote from the heart. She was articulate and powerful. She garnered respect and attention for writing about racism in the feminist movement, sexism among African Americans, and lesbian love. Audre Lorde died on November 17, 1992, in St. Croix. Lorde continues to be an influence in expression and activism. This has been a celebration of the life and works of Audre Lorde, black lesbian, mother, warrior, poet. Special thanks to the Pacifica Archives for recordings and to Lambda.net and to the University of Illinois for biographical information. I'm Kathy Sanchez.
Old and days, golden days, days of mad romance and love. Then gay youth was mine, truth was mine, joyous, free, and flaming life. Then
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Janice Ian.
I'm B.D. Wong.
I'm Kate Quinn.
I'm Armistead Maupin.
This is Dorothy Allison.
A summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community.
The Supreme Court says that we matter and we're valuable.
It says intended bridegroom and intended bride. How are intended spouse and intended spouse?
My name is Billy Bean.
This is Greg Louganis.
I'm Patricia Nell Warren.
This is Edmund White.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
This is Ian McKellen.
I'm Amanda Burse.
I'm Bruce Valanche. And you're listening to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
The showpiece of the homosexual movement.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Please do stay tuned.
You may recognize him as son-in-law Monroe Fikus from the hit TV series Too Close for Comfort, or as one of those Hollywood squares, but most recently he's been the voice of a highly animated amphibian. Charlie Lang has a chat and some laughs with openly gay actor Jim J. Bullock.
Queer duck, he's intellectual. Queer duck, he's homosexual. Please don't think that he's perverse. He's the patient's favorite male nurse. He's okay, he's just fake, 'cause he's openly gay. He's a truly queer, queer duck, queer duck.
I'm gay as a goose.
I'm very pleased to have as our guest Jim J. Bullock, a man who's had a very diverse career as an actor here in Hollywood, and who's currently the voice of the ubiquitous queer duck. Welcome, Jim.
Ubiquitous.
How'd you like that?
That's a big word.
That was a big word.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us, who is Queer Duck?
Queer Duck is a cartoon, little three-minute vignettes about a gay duck and his friends and their adventures.
Can you tell us who Queer Duck's friends are on the show?
Absolutely. There's my boyfriend, openly gay Gator. There's our friend, Bipolar Bear, and Oscar Wildcat. Then my mother, who is played by Estelle Harris, and so funny. That was one of my favorite episodes when I came out. Did you see that one?
That's the first one, I think.
Is it?
I'm coming out.
Attention, everyone. I have an announcement. I am a homosexual.
So what's the announcement?
I'm gay.
Duh.
I feel so liberated. So I said, I'm a homosexual. And they all started cheering and hugging me. So beautiful. Oh, Oscar Wildcat, you just gotta do it.
If I came out, it would kill Mother. I'll do it tonight.
How about you, Bipolar Bear?
Oh, I already told my father. He was totally shocked. And so was his boyfriend.
Openly Gator, I'm seeing my parents tonight. Oh, come with me. I want to tell them about us.
You do? Oh, queer duck. Oh, don't look at me. I'm a mess.
Crocodile tears.
It's really not going to change the world.
But it is quite adventurous.
It is quite adventurous.
And irreverent, too.
And totally irreverent, totally wrong. So wrong, it's right. And that's what I love about it.
It's on Showtime.
Yes, it is on Showtime, and it's also online.
So how did you get involved?
Well, I slept with the director, and I'm very fortunate. No, I was sitting around my house, and I get a phone call. And it's from casting for this cartoon about this gay duck. And they said, would you be interested? And I'm like, hello, yes, I'm interested. So I went into studio and I auditioned for it and I got it.
So Mike Reese is the guy who created Queer Duck.
He is.
And he's originally from The Simpsons. He received 4 Emmy Awards, didn't he?
Yeah. I tell you, that's a home run, isn't it?
That's pretty nice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, did you have a relationship with him before, or did you meet through doing this project?
I never met him. I didn't even meet him at the audition. I went into studio like this, and I put my audition down. And I think I said, oh, my gay God, which got me the role, which I stole from somebody else, so it's not even mine.
Which reminds me of one of Queer Duck's famous lines, which...
Oh, my gay stars.
Oh, my gay,
my gay stars.
Thank you. I was going to ask you to do that. That shows up in every little episode.
Oh, yeah.
Too Close for Comfort was a show that you did for 6 years?
6 years. You know, I came out to L.A. in 1977 with stars in my eyes, of course, like everyone, and was out here for about 3 years. And then I got this role on Too Close for Comfort, which was originally just a 2-week guaranteed role, just 2 episodes, with the possibility of it being reoccurring. I did the first 2 weeks. And then they just added me to the show.
Sort of gave new meaning to the word reoccurring. From 2 weeks to 6 years.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I went from making nothing as a waiter to making network salary. And working with great people like Ted Knight, Nancy Dassault, girls Lydia and Deborah, and Audrey Meadows, Selma Diamond.
So it was a real family environment.
It was. It truly, truly was a family environment. You know, Ted was king of the hill, and he let people know that he was king of the hill. But we all genuinely cared for each other. We really did.
You know, we were talking about Queer Duck's coming out episode, and I'm just wondering, Jim, what your process was like, if there was a process, in terms of coming out in the industry here in Hollywood.
It was a process of not only coming out in the industry, but coming out to myself. During the Too Close for Comfort years, I was petrified that it would get out, that I was gay. Like anyone can look at Monroe and go, oh, he's straight. I mean, now it's like Monroe's like this gay icon, you know, and I'm at the time trying so hard to be butch. Then Hollywood Squares came along.
Right.
And during the Hollywood Squares years, I was coming to a place of self-love more for myself. And also during that same period of time, I discovered that I was HIV positive. That was a true turning point in my life. To where I went, you know what, you have two roads you can choose here. You can choose to love yourself and choose to go with a God that loves you, or you can continue on this path of self-hate and self-destruction. And I chose the first path. When something like that happens, it stops you dead in your tracks. Mm-hmm. And I'm someone, it takes something really hard to stop me in my tracks. It takes a car hitting me before I will stop and think, oh, maybe I shouldn't cross the road here. And it made me, instead of relying on what I had been taught growing up in church, being told what is right for you and what is wrong for you, to go into a journey of finding out for myself what is right for me, for myself, as opposed to what someone else believes for mm-hmm. me. So all that was going on during the Hollywood Squares years. And so during the Hollywood Squares years, I'm just becoming more and more comfortable with who I am in my personal life, and it bled through and into my professional life. And I can remember at one point Rick Rosner, who was the executive producer, took me aside and said, Jim, you're crossing the line here. And I said, what line? The gay line? And he goes, yeah, the gay line. And I said, so what if I cross the gay line? You think somebody sitting in their home wherever in the Midwest who's laughing at me all of a sudden is going to dawn on them they're gay and they're going to like stop and turn off the TV because I'm gay? I said, you know, it's who I am, Rick. I stopped caring about it so much. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'd been outed in the tabloids, you know. There was that whole period at the end of the 80s, early 90s, where Queer Nation, they were outing everyone. They outed me, like people like scratching their heads going, really?
In terms of Queer Duck, is there anywhere that he hasn't gone yet that you'd like to see him go?
I would like to see Queer Duck go to a circuit party.
What would his response be to a circuit party?
I don't know. He just might join right in
yeah,
and jump,
he might.
And, you know, rip his shirt off and be one of those flaggers up on the stage.
Thank you so much for being here.
Oh,
that's
you're
really
welcome.
Exciting.
That was a proudly queer duck, Jim J. Bullock, in conversation with Charlie Lang. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Fenceberry, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Kathy Sanchez, and Charlie Lang contributed program material. Thanks also to Chris Allen. Billie Holiday sang Yesterday's, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some of This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And thanks to AlternaBid and the Stonewall Society, you can still bid on some terrific items in an online auction to benefit This Way Out. Look for the This Way Out auction area at alternabid.com. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2ECR Eden, New South Wales, WOJB Hayward, Wisconsin, KSUA Fairbanks, Alaska, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station.
My gay stars!
Please do stay tuned.